people and Plains Indians. It's not, you know, and the Australian Aborigines too. You know, the afterlife comes after your own life, but the Zuni are really concerned in, mm-hmm. you know, bringing us together in a time.
That's what the clock
yeah, in a time kind of relationship.
Different. Maybe they're not that different.
Synchronistic.
All right. Well, listen, maybe the best thing to do is what we didn't do today, and which I suppose I thought we would start on today, is that you would each report from your area what you consider to be the principal interesting findings or observations about antagonism and aggression. Well, this would really, you know, it's boiling it down because we have had long reports, and now it'll be simply a matter of boiling down, getting down to the essence of
what we should. What we should have started with in the first place.
Huh?
What we should have started with in the first
today.
Place.
Well,
no, I mean that we should have started with the essences.
When could we have started with the essences?
Well, I know.
At the beginning of the year? How could we start with an essence? We don't have raw material. Like
I know.
Now
well,
we have boiled the raw material down. Now we have essences of hope. And we'll come back with the... We will come back with the essences and see where we stand with that.
I think the next time you teach a course like this, you ought to do it on death.
On death.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
Because at the end of that, at least you like if the class doesn't know, at least you'll know something about.
Well, what we should
do? I don't have so many illusions about really coming to know many of these things. I mean, these.
You won't really know anything, but at least you'll have some inkling as to whether there's.
You have to experience it also.
Yeah.
Death?
No, not that.
Oh.
The ceremonial. We could. Why don't we start it?
Well, the next time, that's true. The next time the course goes around, one could.
Have you heard?
It would only work with the same people. I mean, all people have to start from the same place, which is the place of making discoveries.
Let's start an aggression form somewhere.
An aggression form. Okay, so this is what we will do next week is go back over essences.
That can be culturally directed, culturally repressed, or culturally enhanced. And another thing, in a negative way, we've learned something about aggression, that when aggressive self-assertion is denied, people get into all sorts of bottlenecks. In other words, it's difficult to say among the Sikhamis, they deny their aggression in a certain sense, although they had a huge body of religious mythology that was full of threatening devils and ghosts, and yet they were completely unrepressed sexually. However, the quality of their sexuality was...
Yeah, but they were aggressive and antagonistic in the sense that they could, you know, in the sense that although it was... Right, but all right. Nevertheless, I'd say that aggression and antagonism is, you know, absolutely innate, and the fact that it, you know, that it doesn't reproduce similar patterns from people to people and for all time is irrelevant to its innateness. I think what happens is that, like, the form it takes and the channels it takes are societally determined.
Well,
now,
exactly.
Why?
The point.
All right, now why they're societally determined, I don't know. There seems to be a whole constellation of environmental in the broadest sense, but of environmental factors that influence what forms aggression is going to take, especially aggression pushed to the point of violence of man against man, that is to say, pushed to the point of blood. Some societies, I suppose the ones we would consider to be, make a value judgment and consider to be, the most desirable ways of dealing with it, very infrequently go to blood. Others go to blood fairly often as a pattern. But I think that's societally determined. And I think it's very, and I also think, it's very hard to get a handle on just what societally determines it, because it's not just how people are, it's not just kinship relations, or it's not just upbringing, or it's not just levels of frustration. It's a whole pattern of things that goes everywhere from the economics, I suspect, through religion, through everything else that I suppose on in society A, there'll be a constellation of things that determines where violence occurs, and in society B, there's another constellation of things that determines at what point violence occurs, and they need not necessarily be the same.
Of course, and that's because anthropologists have long maintained that the imaginative capacity of the human brain is such that variations on the theme are infinite. In other words, you'll rarely find two cultures that are alike, although they may have certain structural similarities.
I think what we're most concerned with at the moment is probably not aggression or antagonism, but what we're most concerned with talking about is violence. We've gotten to the point that I think all of us agree that that levels of aggression and antagonism occur in virtually everybody we study, right? What we're interested in is the point at which it becomes blood.
By that you mean, Peter, random?
Not necessarily. Not necessarily. I was talking about that earlier, but that's a different facet of the whole thing. I mean even, warfare. I mean, there's some societies that have very, very low levels of warfare. And others that have relatively high levels. But, in each case, it's what I'm getting at is levels of aggression that finally lead to some guy with a gun or a sword or a spear or whatever, or his fist, doing his best to kill somebody else. Taking a blow.
Do you think that the a Plains Indian, if he was asked, would think that what he's doing is violence? If he commits violence. I mean, would have any meaning for them.
I see what you're getting at. I don't know. Probably, within the context of things that are societally sanctioned, I guess people don't consider it to be pathological. Consider it to be violent.
Well,
I don't.
Well,
you see, I know they're not. We're talking about it from the terms of.
Football?
Yeah, it might be.
See, that gets back to the point that Goldman made earlier, which was whether these patterns of antagonism and violence, or whatever you want to call it, are given philosophic and religious meaning, or whether they are, existentially absurd and individual and without any meaning beyond the individual's interpsychic kind of activity. Which is very, very important. And one of the elementary things that we found in terms of the ritualization of aggression is that in many instances, the ritualization crystallizes the quality of aggression, or the excessive quality of the aggression, and exalts it as well as controls it.
Well, maybe there are at least three kinds of aggression, and that is, there is the ritualized aggression, which is the exaltation. This is essentially what we have been going into. Then there is crime, mm-hmm. and that is Well, crime is carrying out aggression simply within the community. It doesn't belong. And then there is something pathological, and that is the nature of the aggression of sort is really bizarre. For example, if an Eskimo attacks his wife, begins to eat her, naturally under strain, this they would then recognize not as a crime, but as pathology. That is, the man was driven by hunger. And he encountered a fantasy that his wife was a seal. I'm talking about an actual cases. And then he attacks her and he tries to eat her. I think we probably would find in all societies a recognition of a certain kind of aggressive behavior as really bizarre, really unmotivated, so that cannot be regarded as a crime.
Right.
A man killing his own children, or a man committing a murder in a very peculiar manner, or a crime that for which no one understands the appropriate motive, that is not a crime, but an act of aggression which no one understands the motivation. So there is the element of the bizarre, and that, I guess, is what we would have to really call pathological, and this would be the case, I think, in primitive society. And then there's criminal aggression, in which the motive is recognized, is understandable, but it's not acknowledged. And that would be, and that essentially is aggression turned inward. Now, almost all the people we have studied recognize that an aggression against the outside, against the external, is the appropriate thing. This is essentially what we have been getting into. In other words, the glorification of aggression and its ritualization. The fact that it receives a philosophic content is really predicated upon the existence of an outsider. This is the role of an outsider. And I think what is interesting about this, because it's really a religious activity, is that all societies look forward to some kind of religious activity which involves an outsider. In other words,
But suicide can be likewise handled that way. I mean, you have the kamikaze of the Japanese, and every once in a while you have societies in which suicide is the noble way out and becomes an act of heroism. So you have that as well. I mean, suicide can be as ritualized as going to war.
It's a self-limiting process. I mean, after it hasn't fulfilled any function.
But it can be rationalized to fulfill a function.
For who, though?
In other words, well, I'm thinking of the Japanese. I'm not... you know, intimately familiar with it, but it seems that when a man was dishonored, he committed suicide in a ritual way that restored his honor in death.
Okay, well, what greater act of aggression can you do than kill yourself? I mean, it's destroying, from your point of view, the whole world.
Right, because of egocentrism.
Yeah.
Suicide, it seems to me, in Japan, does involve the notion of the outsider, because what suicide is intended to do, I think, as the ritual suicide, it acts as a restitution. And that is, the person or family is shamed before the world, before the outside.
Mm-hmm.
And the suicide is a restitution. So in that respect, trying to get at, it seems to me, that the notions of honorable aggression seem to be linked to a relationship with someone defined as an outsider.
Yeah.
And I wonder, a question about the Japanese form of the suicide. The kamikaze, of course, is precisely that, because this is directed.
You mean honorable blood aggression that leads to blood, or don't you mean that?
Yes, well, I mean, a harakiri.
Now, when you say honorable aggression, you're strictly talking about aggression that leads to killing someone.
Killing, right. Yes, and that is right. And this honor has to be, it's associated with something connected with it, with the outside, an outside group with an outside agency, and that's a constant. And that is that
green monkey syndrome. It's the green monkey syndrome.
What's the green monkey syndrome?
You take a bunch of monkeys who live together, for a long time, a monkey colony, and take one of them out of the colony and dye him green, you know, with food coloring.
Oh,
put him back.
Yes.
Put him back inside, and he'll, within a day or so, be torn apart by the others.
Oh, really? Well, of course, this is characteristic of rats. That is a rat of a different bloodline.
In this case, this monkey still smells the same.
He still smells the same.
Yeah,
the rat smells differently.
You know, apparently this, you know, all you do is like, you know, put some green on him.
Yeah.
But you make him look different. You know, make him appear in some way different, and that's the end. And you know, I guess what ultimately what you're saying is that, you know, people who organize in groups for whatever, you know, for the reasons that they do it, you know, mutual gratification of some kind, like a corollary to that is they always are hostile to outsiders.
That is so. Hostility to outsiders is almost in itself a form of honor. And the only kind of honorable violence is that of outsiders. And the only way to make aggression against your own kind honorable is to promote the victim.
You exclude him somehow.
You exclude him in some way and convert him to an outsider. Now, what do you think? Do you think we're dealing here with something simply fairly elementary biological nature or what? Because you see, there are two phenomena here. One, the aggression, we might say, it preserves, it enhances the sense of unity of a group. It's part of defining a group. It's part of defining the boundaries of a group. Well, there are several things. The other one might think of is that it's defensive, sort of territorially defensive.
At what point does unconscious
collective
unconscious emerge? Does what? Well, in what respect about the collective unconscious?
Well, I'm not very familiar with your name. Makes a point of what he calls primordial drives that are left over from the early ages. He considers warfare and competition as some sort of carryovers from the need to be aggressive. And it's just something that we haven't gotten rid of. It's manifested in things like sports, where it's kind of vicarious, not particularly destructive, but it illustrates and satisfies certain early drives or certain ways.
See, what I'm thinking is that what Jung began to pioneer was developed after him by other people, like, for instance, a guy named Eric Neumann. And Eric Neumann found that all of the archetypes of the wise old man, the great and terrible mother, the animal and the animals, were connected with stages in the process of self-actualization, or in their terminology, individualization. So that, which is something that philosophy also concerns itself with, and that is phenomenology and theology. I think it was Aristotle that came upon the concept of the acorn and the oak tree. In other words, everything that the oak tree would be was contained essentially within the acorn, which is a concept, a philosophical concept, which is called teleology, which is can be extended into the realm of psychology, which Jung pioneered, in which Neumann developed through his theory of archetypes, an individual and a society having to pass through stages of individuation. And when we're talking about groups of primitive people, tribes, defining themselves vis-a-vis outsiders, that's perhaps the most elementary way of defining yourself, because your total identity still is subsumed within the group. And in terms of a theory of evolution or of teleology, you then pass through a total identification with a group to, you know, a part, your identification is consisting of realizing that you are you and separate from the group and also part of the group. And this is something that philosophers have also been concerned about. Paul Tillich wrote a book called The Courage to Be, which is concerned with modern man's problem of identity. And in a certain sense, he might be considered regressive because he maintains that Americans in particular are too individualized. In other words, existential isolation and nausea is born from, you know, only a pure conceptualization of the self as an individual with no relationship to a group. And he suggests that the happiest solution is when an individual can be himself and also be a part of a group and relate to others and work and love with others, which is also Freud's answer to happiness, that kind of a thing. So that perhaps what people have been dealing with, philosophers and psychologists, all along is, and what aggression is a part of, is definition of identity and individualization, or the establishment of the individual ego. And this fits in very neatly with societies that we've studied, in which we've found societies to be enhancing of the individual ego or non-enhancing of the individual ego, and how aggression is intimately connected with the development of the individual and self-assertion. In other words, aggression becomes a function of self-actualization or individualization.
Self-validation of self depends upon it. You know, it's this is what I think, I really agree with you, this is like what I think like happened with the Ifugao, that, you know, is that aggression becomes a means by which an individual can validate his identity and his position within the society. The identity you have of yourself, and also your identity among your peers or among
what,
the members
what
of society.
What is it that constantly calls into attention that must be continually maintained?
Well, it's like that idea of
mom
and
mommy.
Don't, you're dead.
Being passive is being nothing.
Being dead, because it's the thing of, you know, without trying to sound more simplistic than it sounds, it's a thing of life against death.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, life means activity and doing things, and
being means, especially as opposed to death, means, fertility and light and activity.
Yeah, that concept
darkness
must be internalized from the environment.
Yeah, continual discharge.
I mean, just what you see around you is continual movement and life.
No, I think it's innate.
And not to be part of that at any time.
And of growth. I mean, the whole concept of growth to maturation and then natural disintegration of the kind only to be reborn again and to grow again and to reach a state of maturation is like a natural truth. And many primitive peoples identify with this very closely and derive a kind of a wisdom from that. And so it becomes a paradigm for a great body of human activity. But this whole idea of aggression being a function of self-assertion and individuation is an ideal. It's like the positive use of aggression, the desirable use, and all of a great deal of the ritual that we've discovered is connected with this self-assertion. But then there's a tremendous body of ritual that falls away from this ideal that is very mystifying and very complex. And much of modern psychology is concerned with individual pathological aggression, and its connection to society is just beginning to be guessed at. I mean, it's.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems to me that self-assertive drives, when they're manifest, answer two questions to the individual. First question is like, how do I prove to myself that I'm a man? And the second question that that they answer is like, how do I prove to others around me that I'm a man, that I'm alive?
Yeah,
okay.
That doesn't have to be done through violence.
No, it doesn't have to be done through violence.
No, like
how? All right, but let me go on just a second. Now, like, as far as a culture or a society is determined, I think that the same question is answered. Through socially, societally determined cultural antagonisms and aggression. That is to say, how does the group prove to ourselves that we are alive, and how do we prove to others that we are alive? I think this is probably the same two questions are asked that require the response to be a self-assertive and an aggressive one. Now, I agree with you that it doesn't have to end up being violent.
Mm-hmm.
Why it does and why it doesn't is the nut that we keep walking around and start trying to get at and never quite get to.
We have a problem about the nature of self, which is made very complicated by Quacquiel's example, because Quacquiel was extraordinary in this respect. That for them, a definition of a being is in terms of names and privileges, which are attached to a being. For example, when a man potlatches, it is said his name may have many names, but one of his names is giving to another name. Quacquiel seems to be saying that what we would regard as ego, namely the palpitating physical psycho-organism, is not the issue with them. With them, the issue is a set of signs, insignia, which define really a collectivized supernatural realm. In other words, the collection of names is something which
beginning. Exactly what chivalry was all about in the Middle Ages.
Okay, in other words, see, we find it convenient to talk about aggression in terms of as an ego definer, an ego enhancer, and therefore giving ego satisfaction. But there are cultures which will deny, as far as we can understand them, they will deny this particular proposition. They will say what is being tested is not the efficacy of a particular efficacy of a particular line. In other words, this is what I'm getting at. Quackius in particular is an example of a case where they deliberately wish to remove the whole play of antagonism and aggression from actual individuals.
Yeah, but you're
begging... Put it in a, well, they put it in a metaphysical realm.
It begs the same question. I mean, like, I guess I probably hung up on this, on the ego thing, and it might be a blind spot with me, but it seems that that they're in fact begging the same question. If they ask the question in terms of validating or verifying the existence of a line, they first identify with the line, and therefore by validating the existence of the line, you know, it's
they're
themselves.
Secondarily validating themselves, which
right.
is,
right.
you know, what I was talking about before in terms of group identity
but
and individual.
You know, I'm not sure that it's the blind spot with me. You know, that I'm not missing something somehow.
You may not be missing anything, but we're just probing this thing. But we do have to, let's put it this way, whether you deal with Kwakiutl, Plains Indians, or you deal with Polynesians. I think what is remarkable about the way in which an aggressive, a very strongly antagonistic, a self-assertive act is carried out has honor in proportion to the degree to which a distance is established between the action and the sheer personal satisfaction of it. In other words, it's got to be in the cause of either a community, genealogical line. It has to be it is removed. Hmm?
Or ultimately a cosmic force.
Or ultimately a cosmic force. In other words, the honorable aggressions, and maybe we really are right, our psychology is sound, and it really gets down to the ego. But then we would like to know why it is that for the aggression to be honorable, must be put in non-ego terms. And when aggression is put really in ego terms, then it is terribly suspect.
Right.
Right.
So this is what we are involved in. So obviously this is an aspect of human nature as well. That is, how do you endow something with honor? And to endow it with honor, you must eliminate we would call sheer egocentrism.
Except that it's a paradox, because among the Plains Indians, I mean, you know, is Jung said something about beautiful about paradox in that it was the only adequate way to express the increment, you know, the impossible to understand, and that ultimately everything of death and wisdom was paradoxical. But, you know, the Plains Indian who becomes metaphorically a cosmic force of life against death, and through success in war fulfills the transcendence of life over death through confrontation and winning over it, so that it is ultimate self-celebration at the same time as, you know, the negation of the self and the transformation of the self into, which is ultimate, you know, as I said before, ultimate self-celebration. So there you have the paradox.
No, but you have the paradox, but he's right in the sense that everybody considers it not only suspect, but, you know, somehow self-deprecating, that, you know, it's recognized that whatever you're doing is, like, you know, it's just out for yourself. I mean, you know, let's put it on really basic terms. Like, guys can't accrue honor by going out and doing stuff just for themselves. They have to be getting some spirit power. They have to be getting something for the group they're with. They have to be acquiring.
Okay, maybe for your people, but
wait a minute.
No,
I think we ought to carry this on outside.
No, among the Crow. they, you know, like Maximilian happened to call them the proudest, most haughty Indians on the plains, and whether this was true or not, I don't know. But when a warrior came back, it was all warriors were huge braggers, and they tried as hard as they could to accredit as many war honors as possible, and, you know, it was tremendous egocentric.
I don't know, because, like, I've never seen anyone more, if you were to look at it on the surface area, more egocentric than the Kwakiutl's, like in the potlatch. Incredible how grand is it of the chief. But I think what you have to have is a metaphor which will absorb the obvious. Like, see, because what a Kwakiutl's doing is aggrandizing the line that, you know, in which he lives and works. And so everything he does is not exactly for himself, it's for that which is within him, which has been handed down.
So secondarily he benefits greatly.
Oh yeah, but only if he can do it by, you know, walking forward by looking with the eyes in the back of his head or something.
Yeah, but the Kwakiutl's aren't the only people that have, you know, believed that their nobility ran in blood. I mean, look at the whole theory of European aristocracy.
Well, yeah, but that's what I mean.
Blood, and somehow being the member of the line makes you superior. I mean, I think that beliefs of aristocracy are, you know, something that can be universally found, and that's what we found in the Polynesians. So that ostensibly believing in an aristocratic love way is also a way of, you know, enhancing the self aristocratic, and it's so it all adds up to the same thing, which is, you know, the celebration of the individual.
See,
I don't think it's going to be displaced though.
Yeah, well, I think that's what the metaphor is. Mm-hmm. But I wonder, like, if criminal aggression might have something to do with people who don't have access to the metaphor, or somehow
we don't feel they have access to the channels in society.
Yeah,
I think it's
that's true. I think, for example, what elevates the mafia from ordinary crime is exactly the point that they have made some kind of a. They have an organization, have a code of honor, and while in the end it does add up as crime, has been endowed with a kind of metaphor. And I think this can account for the extraordinary stability of the mafia as a criminal organization. Because it's very unusual to find a criminal organization that's so stable.
How old is it? It's 100 years old, maybe more.
So to survive and to sustain your organization mean that you really have transcended the whole idea of ordinary crime.
Yeah,
well,
you've internalized
very extraordinary accomplishment.
I have another example which is fascinating, and this year I got to know a person who worked with drug addicts, and he junkies, heroin addicts, and he found that, or he believes that what he discovered was that a community of heroin addicts are sociopathically defined as criminals, right? You know, they rob to feed their habit, and they commit all sorts of crimes. And he found, or he believed that he found, that making it, see, to be a successful heroin addict, to be able to feed your habit, was defining yourself successfully within a negative frame of reference of being a heroin addict. In other words, successful addicts were prestigious within their own circle, so that it became a small society, and it became a form of making it in a negative context, which
sure.
is a very important
like
concept. Jeunet.
That's like Jeunet's thing, you know, of, you know, negative, the more immoral you get, the higher. And also in William Burroughs' book, Junkie, that he kind of says that
that same thing, that what being a heroin addict does is gives you a very simple, unified point of reference, which eliminates all your hassles, in a sense, because you know, I mean, like, heroin is the mother, and the father, and everything that you owe, you know, your existence to. So it's very interesting.
Yeah, psychologically, it's very complex, but in terms of a status system, it's an answer to, you know, white man's America.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in one of the universal things in mythology, Joe Campbell's pointed out, is the idea of a quest, which is the hero goes out of his domain to some other domain, he brings back something, back. Search for the golden fleece, perfect example. In primitive religions, certainly, we see this idea of shamanism. Cooler exchange is going outside. In other words, wherever we have myth and religion, there is this constant theme that which is extracted through some difficulty, always some difficulty, from the outside, is thereby imbued with extraordinary value. And this value brought within, brought home, is a benefit to a woman. When you bring back the golden fleece, you've done something. The implication here is that your self-contained universe will run down just as not having one. Periodically, you must go out and bring something outside in.
This is
a very, very fundamental human idea of value. Something from the outside must be brought in. I wonder whether we cannot relate this basic idea. Yeah?
Go ahead.
Well, I just have another example. Can we relate it really
yeah,
to
I'll
aggression,
be fair.
Which also involves notions of value?
Right, and another very importantly related ideas that Eric Norman developed in his Origins and History of Man's Consciousness, which was the process of individuation. And very briefly, the person begins, the ego begins by being subsumed in the Ouroboros, which is the mythologically envisioned in the serpent who eats its own tail, which is the non-differentiated mother and father. And this is, you know, can be compared to the prenatal state. And then you pass through the individuation or the separation of the world mother and the world father. From that, to assert yourself as an individual, you must kill the mother in you and the father in you, which constitute the two dragon fights, the slaying of the first dragon and the slaying of the second dragon, which is first the father and then the mother. And then you go on your heroic quest. And success in the heroic quest is the winning of, in one case it could be the golden fleece, but in his system it was the achievement of the Vestal Virgin and the attainment of the Hieros Gamos, which is the hero, the masculine hero, and the Vestal Virgin as bride, so that you form your own dual unity, in other words, as a man loving a woman. And the process is similar for women, but it gets very complex. Anyway, in simplified form, this is the process, so that the attainment of the heroic quest is the winning of the Vestal Virgin, which is the achievement of the Hieros Gamos, which is also, you know, the apotheosis of individuation and the blooming of the self and the incorporation of something outside the self within the self. And that's the cycle. But the whole notion of the slaying of the mother and the father is connected with the aggressive killing of that which inhibits the individuality of the person.
Mm-hmm.
which is again the process of individuation and ego definition.
In other words, this is central.
Reduplicating all the processes by which that you believe you've been put here, which include your mother and your father.
Yeah, when Debbie said you kill your mother and your father, it's almost in a paradoxical sort of way. It's like triumphing over death. It's like denying your origins. It's like killing your origins, or like denying the fact that you were dead, and will be dead, and saying that I was here and will be here all the time.
It's defeating those two archetypal identities which threaten to subsume you and annihilate you. The mother being the ocean, the father being the devourer.
Yeah, but what about when it happens individually or actually?
Well, that's on an individual scale. In other words, Norman's whole thesis is that the individual recapitulates this whole process of individuation, that civilization has been going through for thousands and thousands of years. In other words, he begins with Egyptian mythology of the Ouroboros and separation of the world parents and goes all the way through Greek mythology up and then later finishes with Germanic mythology, which was Percival and the slaying of the dragon, and the achievement of the Hylos-Gamos, which moves into medieval kind of European mythologies, and also relates back to Indian mythology.
What is Hylos-Gamos?
Hylos-Gamos is simply the unity of the world hero and the Vestal Virgin.
What does it mean,
Hylos-Gamos? It represents the individuated masculine consciousness integrated with the feminine principle, which on an individual sphere would, in terms of psychology, represent, a mature, individualized man being able to love a woman and have that woman love him in a perfect kind of yin and yang.
Superior marriage.
Yeah. So it's like
the ultimate marriage.
Right. In other words, it's a cycle.
Well, how about when actually all this that's in the the psyche comes out, and if there's actually an example of someone killing their mother and father, which there are.
Of course.
That's totally evading the whole the metaphor and the religious distillation that's really the effect of that is totally inhuman sense, or defeating some religious purpose.
I don't understand.
Well, let me see if I can get this straight. In other words, when there is actually when the myth is represented
not mythically, but actually, then it's totally against the system. Well, totally against the society, and it's the evidence of a neurotic or psychotic personality.
Well, in that sense, it's anarchical. In other words, the individual is acting out that archetypal process of individuation, which civilization is still going through. And you know, Neumann made things, but you know, our civilization has a long way to go. I mean, we're just beginning to realize our certain intellectual strata of our society is beginning to realize through psychology the existence of mother and father dominations within the individual, and individuals are beginning to come to grips with, you know, finding their own individuality and metaphorically slaying their negative identifications with their mother and their father inside of themselves. So that he would maintain that civilization has a long way to go before it achieves its own kind of scale. And in terms of primitive people, he maintains that there's still much more Uroboric. In other words, their consciousness as individuals is still subsumed within, you know, their identity to the group, which is...
Uroboric,
that's the serpent swallowing its own tail, the primal egg, the unindividuated masculine, feminine, and one, the sort of the primitive.
This is primitive.
Tao.
It's
yeah.
Primary.
Yeah.
You don't swallow that.
No, I mean he feels that matriarchal organization came first, and then came patriarchal domination, and it all followed a very clear-cut line of evolution, which is wrong, which we see as wrong. In other words, anthropologically, he was way off in left field and was misinformed and really didn't know what he was talking about. But psychologically and religiously, his thesis really is very fascinating, because it seems to represent a process of individualization that civilized man is concerned with going through.
In the great civilizations, though, I think you might have been right about the matriarchal law.
I'd like to ask the question whether anyone thinks that you can use your aggression, that you can test your aggression, you can test your assertiveness against the supernatural in the same way you can do it violently. For instance, I wonder if the Zuni, by laying themselves on a line in their ritual, saying that if their ritual doesn't work, it implies that they aren't, you know, that they aren't living up to what they should be, and that if they don't perform their ritual, the sun won't come across the equinox. And they're really laying themselves on the line in those rituals. And I'm wondering if that could be their way of testing themselves and asserting themselves.
I wish the clock you did that. It would help me explain a lot.
Yeah. You have a very interesting view of it. In other words, you don't see this as simply a passive carrying out of a ritual.
No.
Yeah. What specifically would lead you to think they are putting themselves on the line? Because to put themselves on the line, there are things for which they must accept responsibility, right? What are those things?
Well, if for instance, if a ceremonial position isn't filled, then the tribe takes it as a sign that they are morally weak. I mean, they assume responsibility for that sort of thing. And if the rain doesn't come, it's because the ceremonial priest didn't perform the ritual correctly, or it's because someone did something wrong. So that they're responsible for the bad things that happen, and so that everything that they, by performing the ritual, they're taking the responsibility upon themselves for the natural events.
What I thought about that, or the idea of like controlling the world through ritual, which is like what the Kwakiutl do, is kind of like if you have a child sitting in a car looking at a traffic light.
that turns red and green and yellow, and that he times it, and then he says just before it turns green, it's going to turn green, and it turns green. Then he controls it. And so then, if you wanted to have a modern-day religion, you could do it on traffic lights. You know, you could have, like, traffic light worshippers. But it's the same, type of thing. So then, what they, like I said, what they make the description of, they take the world and they describe it in whatever metaphor they will do. And then by acting on that metaphor, they make their lives the description of the world. And then if they're not working right, then the world isn't working right.
In the case of the Zuni, Lisa's saying, is that they undertake to organize and regulate themselves in a specified way.
And
if they fail in that, they have then failed in their contest with the other powers. In this respect, they are putting themselves on the line. In the same way, of course, the foot races are also involved. So it's sort of a form of aggression that is there. I mean, here we are, we're opposing, and we have done our part, and now the rains have got to do, the rain gods have got to do their part.
I'm interested in something you were saying previously, but then we got off into another subject. That being, you said for aggression to be socially acceptable, in some way it's not a thing which its primary function is to be ego-centered. I mean,
right.
it's okay if in like some of the Plains Indians when as a result of some activity you can become your ego can benefit, but the primary goal of the aggression is not to become is to benefit the ego. I mean it's
right.
that's okay.
That is right, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
All right.
Question that you have about
it. Well I was wondering if that's what you were getting at.
Yes.
I'd like to dispute that a little bit in saying that that you know the, this being my orientation my view of looking at it, I think that the primary thing probably is self-aggrandizement, is an ego thing, but that it must coincide with societally determined values. That is to say that a reason a guy goes out and does something, you know, say a Plains Indian or anybody else, a reason a guy goes out and does something is primarily for self aggrandizement and primarily for ego gratification. However, it only works. You know, it only works in terms of like how others view him if it is also something that the society has decided is valuable.
But
well, all right.
That's
ignoring.
You see, I think that
that's
like
inescapable.
All right, I think on one hand, if he does it just it's pathological.
Yes.
If he does it just for himself, it's pathological. If he accepts the values of society and does things that are for himself and also societally determined, then it's right.
Right.
That's because it seems that man has always needed to be related to the cosmos.
Deceptive.
And that it's only been in this century, really, that we've had the development of existential philosophy and a denial of man's relationship to the cosmos in any meaningful way, which is a fascinating development in itself. But the reason why it has such religious significance is because man needs to be related to the cosmos above and beyond, you know, the sort of the celebration of the self.
Yeah. Well, there I think we're up against a very fundamental question, something so very fundamental that we either take a stand on it or not. And so, I mean, this is like a starting point of a psychological analysis. That is to say, in the beginning it is the ego. And the ego has worked out its own strategies. And this strategy it has worked out is that really to enhance itself, it must transcend itself. Then it has enhanced itself. But I don't know that we, I'm not so sure that, I think we can accept this as a utterly sense, you know, it's a sound hypothesis, and we can build a whole psychology and ego psychology on it as a Buddha.
Theoretically.
But I don't know that's necessarily the final answer or that it's the last word. And the reason I question it as the last word anyway is that the notion of transcendence seems to be itself so universal that we have to account for that. It seems to me that if the ego gratification alone, if you were to start with the ego gratification theory, you'd find many, many cases in which this is all it is.